Mr. Forbes, Reel 5. I think the first thing we want to touch on is this period when you were attached to the Rifle Brigade, the 8th Rifle Brigade. Could you explain what that was about and how it came?
Well, they did this all over the Army, I think, and they exchanged different roles, different people. Tank people went to the infantry, and some people even went to the RAF and did a bit of flying, but I wasn't lucky enough to do that. But that was just a sort of happy business between two different formations. And it was very good. You saw how the other fellas, the infantry, were always with us when we were in action, and you knew just what sort of things we had to contend with, sleeping rough and holes in the ground and things like that. Well, we did a bit of that when we went to the 8th Army.
What sort of training did you do with them?
It was pretty arduous for me because we'd spent most of our time sitting in a tank on your bottom. We never got a lot of exercise, and it was just infantry tactics mostly, different signals and using the type of radio and the usual sort of tactics for the infantry at war, makeshift enemies and sounding and all that sort of thing. That was mainly what we did, just the same kind of training as they did, but of a lesser violence,
Were you pleased to be back?
I think I was, yeah, that had enough. I mean, you're exhausted.
Now, the next thing really is you went to Chippenham, and some Shermans arrived. Most people seem to have got their Shermans when they went to the next...
Well, from my memory, we seemed to get them in batches, and it was a lovely feeling to see this tank, which we thought was, the be-all and end-all of tanks, the thickness of the turret and the engines, everything was so different from anything it was so different from any British design.
Could you describe the Sherman? I know they can see the one in the War Museum, but if you could describe it, and especially for a driver,
Yeah, well, the first thing that the driver enjoyed was the lack of maintenance. There was only one filter you had to clean it was five normal Chrysler six-cylinder engines interlocked into one crankshaft, So you had... it's surprising how dependable these engines were. I never heard anybody say their engine broke down, mechanically. But it was just the novelty of it was something as well. We thought this was something new and something grand,
Now, as a driver, what sort of a seat did you have, and what sort of,
Fairly comfortable.
Could you raise it?
You could raise it, yeah. Well, when you opened the hatch, you pulled the lever, and you went up on a lift until you were head and shoulders above the level of the tank.
And what was it? Was that the way you'd normally drive it?
Yes. Out of action, you drove it up all the time.
And
one of the dangers would be if somebody stupidly traversed the turret right round to the back, there was a bin on the back, and it would have just chopped your head off, I don't think I've heard of anybody doing that, but that was the only danger you had.
Now, and if you were down, how would you see? What did you have, periscopes or a slit?
Periscopes. This is the periscope the driver had. He had nothing else. Like on the British tanks, there was for instance, on the Crusader in Covenanter, it was square, about that size. There was a flat outside which opened from the inside. But on the Sherman, there wasn't anything like that. When you were battened down in action, you could swivel, of course. That's all you did, just watch around.
What was the view like?
Well, you could imagine a small thing like that. The angle of vision was quite small. But you've got to sort of used to it, you know.
Now, what controls did you have in the Sherman?
In the Sherman, well, you had the two levers that came up and were handy there. It was, you know, for steering. That was the steering mechanism. And your gear lever was just beside the accelerator and clutch and everything, just like a normal vehicle. Everything else was just simple. Switches, you know, the ignition switches and everything were just all beside you there. And there was a space here for...
On your left?
For ammunition. A box of Browning ammunition sat there, which we got rid of and put a cooker in there.
And what about escape? I mean, we'll come on to this later, but you had the hatch above you,
yeah.
That you were half out of anyway, apparently. When you were, what about, there was another way out down below, wasn't there?
There was a floor hatch, but that was only in the 75, you know, the ordinary Sherman issue. But the Firefly didn't have that, because there was no co-drive, it was just full of ammunition.
Now, that you mentioned it, the co-driver. You had a co-driver in the Sherman.
I had a co-driver in the 75, but you didn't have one in the Firefly.
What was the co-driver for, would you say?
Well, you had a gun. You had the forward machine gun, which was used a lot because it was good for forward firing mostly.
That was a Browning.
Browning, yes.
And would you get training on the Browning?
We didn't really need training on that. Once you know about, well, you had the Bren and you had the Beezer, and the Beezer and the Browning was very simple. I suppose I would run against a gunner by describing it. He would probably describe it better than me, but it was a very simple action, just loading the belt and cocking it ready for firing.
So you didn't need much training.
No.
And then the other crew members, there was the commander, tank commander. That would be an NCO or officer.
Yes, well...
What would you say their job was? Just quickly, you know.
Listening for orders and obeying orders, mainly from his troop commander, who are to be orders from... You know, there's the usual system. But...
And they'd pass orders to you, would they, as driver?
Yeah. Usually swearing or something. Usually telling me to wake up or something, you know. Quite often, the first commander I had when I went over there was McCarty.
I'll come to the crew, because I've got... And there'd also be... It's looking at the roles. Now, also in the turret, there'd be a gunner and a wireless operator. Yeah. What was the... Well, they're
all... Well, the wireless operator was always was the loader as well. He had to load the gun all the time. But there was never any problems with...
Did you train on doing all the roles, or were you just basically a driver?
Well, I wouldn't say I became efficient at any of the other roles. I wouldn't be an efficient wireless operator. I would have got by if there was an emergency with the wireless, netting it and your usual call signs. You got your call signs every morning, which were different every morning. But... Well, as far as gunnery was concerned, you got a bit of that, but not a lot. I mean, you had to spend more time training good gunners than mucking about with a driver.
Were you a driver fitter or driver mechanic? I mean,
eventually you got the rank of driver mechanic AFV, which meant another little bit more on your pay, that was all.
What training did you get in the mechanical side of things?
Well, we went on courses to Bovington, and Chilwell was a place. It was a big depot there, but they had very good lecturers and things there. Very good education equipment in Chilwell. You went there, you were like a student, more or less.
Learning mechanics, the tank mechanics.
Maintenance and mechanics, you know, the operation of engines. You got a bit on the Wilson pre-select gearbox, which was kind of beyond the average brain. I wouldn't like to go into details about that, but it was very difficult for any ordinary brain to take in the system of the police.
What else would you be learning?
I don't know why they gave you this, a lecture on this, when we didn't have any. I didn't think we had any vehicles that had that.
And what other training would you get, maintenance-wise? I'd either Bovington or Chilwell.
The driver didn't need much more training than just his ability to handle his vehicle.
What do you think made a good driver, tank driver?
That's a difficult one. I would say just his quick response to orders. If he was urgently told to reverse and go left or something, he would do it right away without... And the ability to handle your controls. That was the main thing.
Do you think anyone could be made a good driver? Or
another point would be that to be alert to everything, you've got the signals going through your earphones of what was going on outside, the orders to your commander living came to all the crew. And you're on ASAP, you're all on it, and you sort of learned to listen to what was going on. Sometimes you were able to anticipate something, if some order came that you were to move at a certain time, you were ready for it. So that was the sort of thing.
Were some drivers noticeably better than others then? I mean,
I think so, because some drivers had a better mechanical knowledge of the operation of their vehicle, therefore they were better drivers. I don't know. I can't tell you where I was. I'm not.
Now, did you form crews straight away, or at first did you just train generally?
Well, in training, I think in training you got some things shuffled about, but generally you stuck to the same crew. That's a thing I would have to think about, because we had a lot of personalities that are in your mind. But when you had them in your crew or not, I don't think I could give you details about that.
So the first crew you'd know would be the one you went overseas with, yes, that you could name. Well, we'll save that till then. Yes. What sort of training did you do with the Sherman? Anything new came in while you were at Chippenham or?
I think basically the training would be the same, but just different schemes emphasised on different things. I think probably the last scheme was Tiger. No, it wasn't. It was Percy, wasn't it? I can't remember. But the last scheme, we were more or less anticipating the enemy more. It was more working with the infantry and...
Would you,
as a driver, you don't really know so much as the turret crew what went on.
What about things like taking up hold down positions? The practicalities of tank fighting. Did you practice that? And could you just explain for us, perhaps, what taking a hold down or a position was, or turret down?
I think a commander had to sort of make a quick assessment of the ground, the terrain that he was in, and look for a safe spot where he could probably get a good field of fire and still have most of the tank protected. A hedge or a sunken lane probably was all right, but you had to make sure that you were able to withdraw or get out. That was one of the important things. Once you found a place, you had to look to escape. If you were fired on by something heavy like an 88 or something like that, you wanted to get out quickly. You would probably look for an easy way out. Or you wouldn't put your tank in a position where you'd have difficulty getting out. For instance, across a sunken lane, you might go hull down and get bogged, you know, stuck, and that was a bad thing. And it was we got a lot of practice in smoke, using smoke for defensive cover, you know. You got things like that were all taken care of on the gunnery ranges, like Leneyhead and Kirkcudbright.
How did you use smoke? Do you remember that? That'd be the gunners that mainly did it.
Well,
wouldn't
you had a smoke. I think you had a shell. I'm not very sure. Jack Edwards would tell you all about that. He's well up in gunnery. But I think you had a smoke shell that you could fire. You also had dischargers at the side of the tank, like cylinders that you put a smoke grenade in and fired for quick withdrawal, that sort of thing.
Yeah. You were there. You were at Bury St Edmunds and Newmarket for a long time, from August 42 right through to June 43.
Yeah.
Any other things that you remember about, or any incidents you recall from that period?
No. I could remember that very often. this is just a sort of social thing. You went into Bury St Edmunds, and probably you would get involved in something and go past your 23:59 was the hour that you were supposed to be back in camp, or you were on a charge. But the thing about the camp that we had at Fornham St Martin's, I think it was well away from the town and that, and you had to walk home if you missed the truck. And I can remember going along there, and there was a lot of orchards along there, and we thought we were a bit hungry, so we nipped over a wall and started eating the apples off. He got caught by a dog or something, and we had to run for it. But there was ways into the camp that you could, undetected, you know, across barbed wire fences and things. And we eventually got in one night to through the back door to our hut, and our hut luckily was beside another regiment, an artillery regiment's cookhouse. Their cookhouse was near there, and so we sat at about 2 o'clock in the morning in the hut, and we all said we were starving, hungry, you see. So I think it was this chap, what was his name, Dick something. Anyway, he decided he was going to house break into the cookhouse and see what food he could find. So he had gone in there, but in going in through the window, he had knocked over some bottles of sauce on the floor. And of course, that would have been evidence that something had happened and be in trouble. So the cook had all his towels drying above the stove, so he took all the towels down and wiped the floor with them. But I then had to bring them out as evidence. So there was a cook. The cook shot the towels the next morning. But anyway, we had tins of peaches galore that he'd found in there for that night. And that's just the sort of things that happened in that camp. It was very loose, and, you know, nobody seemed to care. Because it was from there we were on getting embarkation leave, and there was a lot of relaxation.
Now the next move would be down to Bridlington, or well, Rudston, just outside Bridlington. That's
right, yeah.
June 43. Mm-hmm. What do you remember of the situation down there?
Yeah, well, it was another hutted camp, but it was in a very tight sort of wood. It was in a wood, and the result was that most of the Dyson huts were very damp, and that's where we got this impetigo that used to be called Barber's Rash, you know, the bad skin on the faces. Of course, we all got painted with Jensen Violet. And we looked a sorry lot. And, I think they used to go into Bridlington or something with sick parades and march along the street and as they, like commandos, you know.
Did a lot of you got it then?
There was quite a lot of us, yeah.
Do you know what caused it?
Well, they claimed it was caused by some Canadian blankets that we got from the Canadian regiment. They weren't very clean. I don't know. It could have been something like that, but we don't really know.
Did it take long to clear up?
No. We got the gentian violet was quite good. Eventually it dried up, but wasn't a very nice shaving.
Then what else about Rudston?
Rudston, well, training started pretty soon. We did these sort of schemes where we went out and you were probably hidden behind hedges and things around this field, and we practiced camouflage pretty well. You weren't allowed to walk across the field, but it's surprising from the air how footprints can be seen across fields. So we did a lot of that.
You're aware of the air thing, yeah. Then. What about how
the RAF sent across reconnaissance planes as a to check on it to see how, and we got sort of full marks the first time, but somebody had walked across the corner of a field the second time and lost a few marks that time.
And how did you actually hide the tanks? What did you use to camouflage?
Camouflage nets, which were nets with little bits of coloured canvas tied into them. But they were quite good. I suppose they were quite good. They were quite good in the air. That's how we covered the tanks with that.
And what other exercises? There seemed to have been a lot of exercising on the moors from Bridlington, well, of that area.
Yes, there was.
The black cock and eagle are the two that they. Yeah. Do you remember much about them?
Not at all. Fairly ordinary. Being a driver, you were just obeyed orders, and you never really knew what was going on half the time. The only signal that you thoroughly enjoyed was a signal to go home. You know, there was a lot of boredom in it for crews, because there was somebody getting training, but everybody couldn't be involved all the time. So sometimes you were quite bored on an exercise.
One thing they did was that they had a trip up to the Kirkcudbright tank range. Yeah. Do you remember that?
No, I was only once up there, and I was on one of the tanks, driver of one of the tanks that was used, taken up there to be used for gunnery. So. Again, I was just kind of bored, but I did get a little bit of gunnery. That was about all. Nothing really exciting happened there. Oh yeah, but there was one. Bobby Bruce, one of the officers, I think it was him. He got a misfire, and the shell went into the breech and didn't explode. And you have to wait a certain time and then open it up and chuck it out. And I think Bobby kind of panicked and got a fright and left the tank. Something like that. But that was the only incident that I can remember on the ranges. Firing was good. We didn't reckon to be all that good. There was one fella got top score. He hit his target every time, so he must have been unusual.
And you were getting quite near the time, you know. Were you aware of things that D-Day was coming, or the second front was coming?
No, I think the things that we're getting to do were obviously pointing in that direction, like waterproofing the tanks and keeping the check on the equipment and all the sort of things you would do in preparation for going abroad. They're just you got the feeling fairly early, and what jobs you were given to do indicated that there was going to be something soon. And then of course the environment was the same. You mean there was masses of Lancasters and Halifaxes going over, and you knew by then the second front was on.
Now that sounds more like when you went to Aldershot, yeah. What about the waterproofing? What do you remember of that?
Well, we thought it was a bit ridiculous, and as most soldiers did think that the thing was ridiculous, because it was so involved with Bostik and new material. Every bolt had to be painted with this and screwed in, and just it was all, we think was necessary, because I mean if you had your bottom plates all tight, as tight as could be, it would be reasonable, I think.
What about the engine though? I mean if water got in?
The engine on some of the tanks, you had a curling. You couldn't allow the exhaust to become immersed in the water because that would choke the engine right away. But I think we had a big cowling thing that fitted on the bar, which took the exhaust up above the level. I think the tanks were supposed to be able to wade into, I'm not sure whether it was 9 or 12 feet, something like that.
Did you test this?
Yes, we went to Hull actually, and there'd been a bombed area in Hull, and there was a big cellar that had been exposed, and they filled it with water to about 12 feet or something like that. And you took your tank after it was waterproof, and you drove into this and out of it on the other side. And that was a very good place because it so happened that this was looked after by an RAF detachment with balloon barrage. They were in charge of two or three balloons. And they had a hut at which we, the drivers of the waterproofing tanks, were allowed to use to sleep in that. And they fed us. And boy, they did feed us. I don't know where they got all the food from. But I think they got very good rations in the RAF. So we lived like fighting cocks in that place while we were training on waterproofing. That was
in Yorkshire.
Yeah. Now,
you mentioned you saw the air armada. Was that round about just before D-Day? Or?
That was probably about the 5th of June. Probably the day before the actual landing, I think. I may be wrong, but I think that was just about. Because I can remember we were busy waterproofing and we looked up and the sky was black with planes. Well, we knew then that the invasion was on. And I suppose we got a bit excited. I can't remember my feelings at the time. But we must have been, excited.
Were you nervous at all? Because you must have known you were going in.
It never seemed to come to that, you just had your mates beside you and you just went on as usual. And I think there was a sort of feeling that, nothing's going to happen to me sort of thing, I don't think I was actually nervous.
Now, the next thing then is when they moved down from Aldershot and it started getting nearer. What's the next thing you remember?
Well, the journey down, the convoy of tanks and everything, wasn't very pleasant because of the dust. And the weather was dry and the roads were dusty, and the tanks are notorious for kicking up dust. The probably would have been worse if the exhaust wasn't diverted, but it was bad enough. The tracks kick up the dust.
Did you have goggles?
You had goggles, yeah. We all had white around there and black. The worst part of it was a section of the south of England that seemed to have a red soil, and the dust, of course, was red. And it seemed to go for our eyes. And I can remember one place where there was a family of people at the roadside with basins and buckets and of water, hot water and everything. And we were all, as we came along, we all stopped, got down, and they bathed our eyes and everything. That was a nice episode in the journey down to Gosport.